Let's see. Okay, so put that puppy on. Now let's do the record. Record to the cloud.
This meeting is being recorded.
Okay, and we are getting removed. We're starting to move here. Let's share the screen back to the Yahoo Finance. And welcome, everyone. It's the 9th of April. My goodness, we're surviving this. At least so far, everybody in the class seems to have survived. My apologies, I did not record on Tuesday, which was a mistake. So if you go to the website, you will see under chapter 17, I'm sorry, chapter 17, it says, oops, I forgot to press record. Please use the two online presentations above. Either, any of these, they're on iTunes, YouTube, 3C Media Solutions. This is the audio right here, and here's the audio visual. And then if you want to use Apple, you go to iTunes and search for Business 123. Or you can, the link is above in a few of the other, up between the first three or four chapters, the link gives you the list of presentations, but you can't link into iTunes individual presentations. You can only link to the class, and then you scroll down and find the presentation you want. So, is anybody using these presentations? These presentations, are any folks out there using these? Because this is what the the online students are supposed to do. And of course, if you walk through Canvas, it walks you through the presentations one at a time, as opposed to just seeing the Wonder Professor website, which is like Craigslist, you know, just a bunch of links. But I think they're pretty straightforward. I'm not biased or anything. But please do contact me about how you're using the class and if it's working for you. I certainly hope so. You know, we're doing the best we can given the circumstances. So let's go back to Yahoo. And we took a look that actually, as Ruben said, we're coming back. And I believe that we're going to come back if we're around, if we survive. Okay, so enough of that. Let's leave Yahoo there and go to presentation. We're going to finish up chapter 17 today with our financial ratios. We'll burn through these. We'll try not to spend too much time on them because they're relatively, straightforward. And then we'll get started on chapter 7, which has some good stuff in it, but the reality is we'll this is the heavy lifting. Chapters 5, 6, 17, study them over and over and over again. Next week, we're going to have exam number 3, which is basically a review of exam number 2. So make sure you can do those worksheets. If you need help with those worksheets in chapter 6, contact me. If you did not do exam number 2, you need to contact me sooner than later. Don't wait. And so some people still haven't taken the exam in the face-to-face and online. And this is typical. Online, it's just really difficult to get to herd the cats and keep people with us. So that's our goal for today, is to get through the rest of chapter 17. Take a look. We'll take a look again at the assignment sheet for chapter 17. But then we're going to take a look at chapter 7, where we start a bit of silliness, but not as much silliness as next week when we get to chapter 8. Okay, so but first we need a good joke, right? And I told you the joke. I told it to you twice, right? I thought I had told you the joke about the guy with the little red sports car. But now we have to tell you another Battle of the Sexes jokes where we make fun of the guys, okay, because we want to insult everybody by the end of the semester. And so here was a situation where this woman was walking along the road downtown, and she sees two hearses and a limousine going slowly along this road, and a line of 200 women marching behind it, behind them, the two hearses and the limousine. And so this is intriguing. So she walks up to the first woman in the line and starts walking with the parade, I guess you'd say, the funeral procession, I guess. She's thinking, what is it? Is it a parade or a funeral? And she asks the woman that, is this a parade or is this a funeral? And the woman says, well, kind of both, you know, kind of both. And the woman says, well, who died? Who's in the hearses? Well, the first one's my husband, and the second one is his girlfriend. And the woman said, oh, well, who's in the limousine? Oh, that's the guest of honor. That's my dog. Your dog? Yeah, my dog. Well, see, my dog caught my husband and his girlfriend in our bed, and she ripped their throats out and killed them. And the woman was, oh my goodness, what a dog. Can I borrow that dog? And the woman at the beginning of the line says, get in line. Get in line. So. Remember that, guys, okay? Okay, I know, I guess it doesn't work as well if it's when you're all remote. Can't see people's faces and reactions, but I think it's a cute joke. Okay, so on Tuesday, we went through the idea of financial ratios and the balance sheet, the income statement, and we had gotten through the profitability ratios. So if you have not, you should really have these the ratio formulas in your hot little hands, or at least available on the screen, and I'll bounce back and forth between them to remind you. But we went through the common stock ratios, and much of that is review, and then we did the profitability ratios. So today we have the liquidity ratios, activity, and leverage ratios to work through. So let's get started on those. So let's bounce through these guys real quickly and get to the liquidity ratios. Now, the liquidity ratios, if you remember, liquidity is a fancy way of saying, do you have enough cash? Or can you turn your investments easily into cash? And so liquidity ratios are financial ratios concerned with a firm's ability to meet their day-to-day operating expenses and satisfy their short-term obligations as they come due. Now, let's see if I can, where's that pointer? There it is. Pointer. And so in other words, can you make payroll? Can you pay the rent? And of course, this is a very topical issue right now with all the small businesses just saying, what are you talking about? I haven't been in business for weeks. I can't pay the rent. I can't pay my employees. I furloughed them. So we're going to see that many of the things that we're discussing today, you know, we're talking about big corporations, but they're very important to anybody who has in business. So the two that you hear most about are the current ratio and the quick ratio, or sometimes called the acid test ratio. And then this net working capital is actually not a ratio. It's the one outlier in the whole group. But it's simply another way to restate it. So let's take a look at the current ratio. Very popular financial measure. You take your current assets and your current liabilities and you divide the current assets by the current liabilities. These are on the balance sheet. And if you remember, we discussed this, again, don't worry, we don't have to do any accounting, but the accountants call any assets, any liabilities that are due within 1 year current. And everything else is long term, which for us finance kind of people, that's kind of silly. Long term is 5, 10, 20 years, but no, not to the accountants. So the current ratio is a good indicator of how stable a company is. Anything above 1 is normally considered acceptable. And think about it. If it's above 1, that means your current assets are greater than your current liabilities. That's how a quotient works, right? Anything that is equal to 1, that means that the two would be equal. If your current assets equal or exceed your current liabilities, you should be able to satisfy your short-term obligations without any problem. And obviously, the greater the number is, the better, until you get to situations, it's like some of these tech companies that have, you know, current ratios that are in the, you know, 60s or 80s or 100s because they have so much cash and they don't really have that many debts, unless they load themselves up with debt, which is what some of the companies like Apple has been doing. This, the money's so cheap, they figured, well, why don't we just borrow? We can pay it back. We got so much cash. So let's take a look at the we use the balance sheet. Here's the balance, right? Isn't that the balance sheet? Right. So Ford, balance sheet. So here we have our assets and our liabilities. But remember, we're only interested in the current assets. So what are the current assets? 114,050. That's 114 billion 50 million because you have to multiply everything by 1,000. But we can get rid of the last three zeros. So remember that number, 114,050. And what we're going to do is we're going to divide that by the current liabilities, 98 billion 130 million. So if you take, I'm going to do that. I already did it. I have my cheat sheet here. But obviously it's going to be greater than 1 because you see the current assets are greater than the current liabilities. So 114,050 divided by 98,130, and we get 1.16. So in other words, what the current ratio is saying about Ford is, yeah, they can pay their debts. They can make their payroll. They can pay their short-term current obligations. They're not going to be hauled off the bankruptcy court. Does that make sense? Any questions? Any thoughts? Just raise your hand, scream and holler. And why does this disappear? Let me manage. Okay, there they are. I hope it stays there. Let's see if it stays there. I don't know if it will. Okay, so I can see anybody raising their hand. Yes, no, go slower, go faster, more, clear all. So this has the a list of the participants, and I guess if you raise your hand, it would come over here. I'm not sure. I'm still getting used to this darn thing. Okay, so let's go back. Now, the next one is actually not a ratio, the net working capital. It's essentially what it does is it gives you the absolute dollar measure of liquidity. So instead of dividing current assets divided by current liabilities, you subtract. So let's read together. The net working capital is the current ratio in dollar terms. So in other words, if the current ratio is greater than 1, then your net working capital will be positive. If the current ratio is less than 1, it will be negative. And a higher number means, you know, you're more liquid, you're less likely to wind up in bankruptcy court. This one's not as popular as the current ratio, and as we said, it's really not a ratio, it's the dollar terms. So if we go back to the balance sheet, what we would take is 114,050 minus 98,130, and we wind up, let's just spitball it, with about, you know, $6 billion in net working capital. So that's the net working capital one. And I think I did it here somewhere. Where is it? Yeah. No, wait. Did I do that right? Not 6, 15, 16 billion, around 16 billion. I didn't do a very good job of spitballing, did I? 114, let's do it, make sure. Let's do it. 114,050 minus 98,130. Yeah, we get almost $16 billion in net working capital. So Ford's pretty flush with the cash, right? Well, let's see. Let's continue. Because the next one has a great name, the acid test ratio. Isn't that a great name? Sometimes called the quick ratio. And what this is saying, look, folks, yeah, sure, you got a current ratio that looks pretty good, but what happens if your inventory is included or excluded? I'm sorry, excluded. Because you might have a ton of inventory that you can't sell. It's become obsolete or undesirable. So let's read. Unlike the current ratio, the acid test ratio excludes inventory. This ratio measures the ability of the company to meet its short-term obligations, even if the current inventory becomes obsolete, undesirable, and hence difficult or impossible to turn into cash. So think about it. Right now, people are not going out and buying cars, right? Car sales have fallen off a cliff. So Ford and the others are going to be stuck with a bunch of inventory that is not going to become obsolete. You know, somebody, a car that's 2 or 3 years old is still a pretty darn good car, but they can't turn it into cash very easily right now. So we're going to do the same calculation, but this time we're going to exclude the inventory. So notice that this formula is actually a little overly complicated. All we really have to do is subtract the current assets minus, we have to subtract the inventory from the current assets. So if we go back to our balance sheet, go back to the balance, what's going on? Hope I didn't crash my browser. Oh no, folks. Hello. I hope I didn't crash my browser. Are you still there? Is everybody? I hope my computer didn't crash.
We're still here.
Yeah, we're still here, but it's not. I'm not going. I don't know what's going on. Let me close this guy. See if that does it. Nope. My browser seems to have frozen. Oh, there it comes. Here it comes. Coming back. It's coming back. Okay. So if we go back to the balance sheet, we take a closer look at the current assets. So you see here, you got cash, short-term, accounts receivable, inventory. So if we take the inventory away from the current assets, that's 114,050, right? Subtract out the inventory, 10,790, and I get 103,260. Hopefully you're doing this as we go along. So you see we're down to, we've gotten rid of this inventory that we're not going to look at in the acid test quick ratio. And so I got 103,260. I hope you guys got that too. And now I'm going to divide that by the current total current liabilities, 98,130, and I get 1.05, which is what I had. Yeah, 1.052. So still, it's above one. The current ratio, the acid test ratio, like the current ratio, is still above one. Which is saying, look, even if Ford's inventory just completely becomes obsolete, which is not, or in this case, not selling, we can still make our short-term obligations. Okay? All right. So, again, these are fairly straightforward. So if I'm going too fast, just scream and holler. And then what we'll do is we'll just do one or two of the next ones. We won't do all of them. Okay? We won't go through all these. These are called the activity ratios, sometimes called the efficiency ratios. And these are financial ratios that are used to measure how well a firm is managing its assets. So we're going to find out how many times we turn over our accounts receivable, how many times we turn over our inventory, and our turn over our assets. Activity ratios measure a firm's ability to convert different accounts within their balance sheets into cash or sales. Companies will try to turn their production to cash or sales as fast as possible because this will generally lead to higher revenues. And I think what we'll do is we'll skip the accounts receivable calculation. We'll go to the inventory because that's a little bit easier to that's a little bit better of an example. But here is the accounts receivable turnover. You take your total revenue, that's from the income statement, that's that top line number, and my apologies, the formatting is a little funky on this. On Google Docs, divided by accounts receivable. And what are accounts receivable? You accountants know. That's money that's going to come in the door. We've already sold the products or the services, and now our clients have to pay us. So that's money coming in the door. The higher the number, the better, because it indicates the return a company is getting from its investments in accounts receivable. What? Well, look, if you are selling stuff but not getting the money that day, you're indirectly extending an interest-free loan to your clients. So if you've taken business 123, business math, you learned about net 30, right? And accounting too, they talk about it in accounting too. They will give you 30 days or net 60 days to pay it off. A high ratio implies that the company operates either on a cash basis or its extension of credit and collection of accounts is receivable, is efficient. A low ratio implies the company should reassess its credit policies in order to ensure the timely correction of imparted credit, not earning any interest for the firm. This is, in other words, come on, pay us, folks. You know, you're taking too long to pay us. Or that might just be how the industry operates. And I haven't worked in the defense industry for a long, long, long time, but they were notorious. You know, Uncle Sam will pay for the aircraft carrier, don't worry, but they just take their good old sweet time. And there's an interesting story about that. In the late 70s, 1970s, late 1980s, the Defense Department was kind of coerced, nudged by Congress to use a lot more smaller companies. You know, we not only just want to use these huge defense contractors, we also want to use smaller companies. And so they went out and did their best to find small companies to meet their, you know, get their products and services. But then they did their usual, well, we'll get back to you, you know, we'll pay you 6 months, a year, don't worry. And the companies were, no, you don't understand. You know, I'm not a huge defense contractor like General Dynamics or Raytheon or Boeing. You know, you have to pay us now because we got to make payroll. So my understanding is that the Defense Department did ramp up their accounts payable. They paid their bills a lot faster. So we'll skip this one calculation, but let's take a look at the inventory turnover, because this one actually, you know, you can actually relate to, especially when you walk into a grocery store or something. You take the top line number, but this time you divide it by inventory as opposed to the accounts receivable in the previous slide. The higher the number, the less time an item spends in inventory, and the better the return the company is able to earn from its funds tied up in inventory. So let's take a look at Ford's. Okay, so we need the total revenue. That's on the income statement. And remember the total revenue, 155,900. Remember that. So I'm gonna write that one down. 155,900. And now we divide that by the inventory. 10,790. Whoops, I messed up. Let's try again. 155,900 divided by the inventory. 10,790. And I get 14.45 or so. Is that what I got on my cheat sheet? Let's make sure I did it right. So what does that mean? What does 14 mean? It means about every 3 weeks or so, Ford turns over their inventory. And so think about it. You walk into a grocery store and you see it's all filled up, right? But how often are they turning over that inventory? Well, in grocery stores, it turns, you know, you don't see, sometimes you see the people stacking the shelves, but they're always stacking the shelves, especially with things like diapers and milk and stuff that really moves over and over, turns over and over again. So in the case of Ford, now Ford's a little unusual because they have the dealerships are actually the ones that are turning this stuff over. You walk onto the lot and you know, you see a car there, and then you think about it. Oh, you know, I might want to go back and buy that car. And you come back, and 2 weeks later, it's gone, right? Because every 3 weeks, they're turning over the inventory. And do you want to turn over inventory? Sure. You really don't want inventory. Why? Because inventory is an investment that represents a rate of return of zero. Let's read together here. As with all these ratios, we have to compare with industry averages. A low turnover implies poor sales and therefore excess inventory. A high ratio implies either strong sales or maybe they're just buying too much inventory, right? High inventory levels are unhealthy because they represent an investment with a rate of return of zero. It opens up the company to trouble in the case of falling prices or obsolete products. But therein lies the dilemma of the car dealership, for example. You want a lot of cars on the lot because that draws people in because they look at all the different cars. But at the same time, those things are not making any money until you sell them. So what you ideally would love, and that's why car dealerships keep trying to get bigger and bigger and bigger, is to just be so big that you're constantly having a huge turnover of cars so that you have enough cars to get people on the lot and then sell the damn thing, get them off the lot, because you don't make any money until the darn thing is sold. So does that make sense? Any questions? Think about it now. When you walk into a grocery store or a Home Depot or someplace like that, big box store, and think about the turnover. What's going on? Well, and as we know now, toilet paper is turning over like crazy. And if you've ever worked in a store and were a stocker, obviously you understand this really well. And then the same thing is true for slide number 33, the turnover of the entire total assets. So we take the total revenue, that top line number, and then we divide it by our total assets. Well, in the case of companies like Ford and other highly capitalized, meaning a lot of resources, a lot of assets, this is going to be a fairly small number compared to a pizza shop or a shoe shop. Because if we take that total revenue, again, as the revenue is the 155,900, and you divide that by the total assets of $258 billion. So let's do that. 155,050 divided by 258,500, and you get what, about a 0.6 or so, 0.59 point, yeah. So Ford is only turning over those assets about, half a time a year. But that's typical of car companies because they have, they just have huge assets. So the total asset turnover measures the firm's efficiency at using assets to support sales and revenue. The higher the number, the better. Companies with low profit margins tend to have high asset turnover. How many, packages of milk or toilet paper are you selling? Those with high profit margins have lower asset turnover. You don't sell that many cars compared to toilet paper, but you make a whole lot more money selling a car than you do selling a package of toilet paper. So that's the idea behind that. So now let's take a look at our last group, and these are the leverage ratios. And these actually should look familiar to some of you if you've taken Business 121, because they're the same ratios similar to what we do with personal finance to see how our debt levels are. Leverage is another way to say debt. Debt is often referred to as leverage. And the idea here, we're going to use this term leverage over and over again, is that you're using other people's money to make your money. You are using the borrowed money as a lever to increase your earnings. Which is great as long as you can make your debt payments. but some people, myself included, are not that happy about debt. I would rather, my motto has always been make love, not loans. When you hear one firm buying out another firm using borrowed money, that's often referred to as a leveraged buyout. So these are financial ratios that are used to measure the amount of debt being used to support operations and the ability of the firm to service its debt. So here's the debt to equity ratio. You take the long-term debt that's on the balance sheet and the total stockholders' equity on the balance sheet, and you divide them. A measure of a company's financial leverage calculated by dividing long-term debt by shareholders' equity indicates what proportion of equity and debt the company is using to finance its assets. A higher debt-to-equity ratio generally means the company has been aggressive in financing its growth with debt. This can result in lower earnings as a result of the additional interest expense. Sometimes investors only use interest-bearing long-term debt instead of total liabilities. I'd rather use total liabilities. The lower, the better. So let's take a look at the balance sheet for Ford. And we find the long-term debt is substantial at $102 billion. And their equity is only $33 billion. So their debt-to-equity ratio is 300%. Now, if this were an individual, and some of you might be in that situation, especially if you're younger and you have, student loans, you'd say, oh my goodness, this person is drowning in debt. But in the case of car companies, that's how we operate. It's not something I prefer, certainly, having three times the amount of liabilities than you do your equity, your assets, your net worth is what the term we use in financial planning and money management. But that's how the car companies work. It's just that's de rigor, as they say. And we do the next one. This one right here. When you read the Intelligent Investor, which you're going to, right? Yes. Nod your head. Yes. Eventually, not yet. Don't read it first. Read One Up on Wall Street or The Random Walk Down Wall Street. You will find that Mr. Benjamin Graham, he does a masterful job of using all these financial ratios. He was very big on this one. In other words, folks, how many times in the year do you earn your interest expense? Because if you don't pay your interest payments, right, you're going to get hauled off the bankruptcy court. So these are on the income statement. We take the earnings before interest and taxes and divide them by the interest expense. Normally, three or four times a year, we earn our interest expense, we're okay. And if we go back, taking a look at the income statement, with Ford in the past several years, where is it? Here's the interest expense, and then the earnings before interest and taxes were far exceeded that. Look at that. In 2018, they earned almost, $5.6 billion, and they paid $1.2 billion in interest. In 2017, they earned over $9 billion before interest and taxes, and they only had to pay $1.1 billion. But last year, they had to pay $1 billion, but they only earned $368 million. Right. Oh, my goodness. So that ratio has gone very low. It's taking them 3 years, basically, to not quite 3 years, two and a half years now. And of course, remember, earnings are changing. They're probably going to not make any money this year. They're probably going to lose money this year. No, they're definitely going to lose money this year. So instead of earning their interest about, five, six, seven times a year, now it's taking them 2.5 years in 2019 numbers to earn that interest. And Mr. Benjamin Graham would not be impressed by this. He would not. He would be saying, you want to stay far away from companies that are not earning at least their interest three or four times a year. Question? Was there a question? Okay. So I get 0.36. So in other words, about one-third, they're earning about one-third a year. In 1 year, they're earning about one-third of what they owed in 2019 for interest payments. And that's, in my humble opinion, a very bad sign. And Mr. Benjamin Graham would agree. But that's only one thing we need to look at. And this is typical, though, of the car companies. This is very, very typical. When there's a recession, they just start losing money like crazy. When there's good times, they make money like crazy. So they are the quintessential, which is a fancy way of saying the poster child for a cyclical company. When the economy's doing really well, they do phenomenally. When the economy's doing poorly, they get hammered. And our last one, right? That's our last one, is total debt to total assets. Oh, wait a minute, maybe it's not. Yeah, it is. That's our last one. So let's take a look at this one. And again, this one should look familiar. This is very similar to what we do in financial planning and money management. We take our total liabilities and divide it by our total assets. Total debt to total assets includes both short-term and long-term debt. If it varies substantially from debt-to-equity ratio, the company may be relying heavily on short-term debt, which can denote more risk. It's similar to thinking, how am I funding my business with a SBA, Small Business Administration loan, which is a long-term debt loan, or am I funding it with credit cards, which are short-term debt, which can get me in really big problems. So we go to the balance sheet, total liabilities minus total assets, divided by total assets. So let's go to the balance sheet. Total liabilities, 225, let's forget the last three numbers, by 258. And it turns out you get a, you know, almost 100%, about 88% or so, is there a total debt, total liabilities to total assets. Again, if you were an individual, certainly, in my humble opinion, an individual does not want this level of debt. And when I teach financial planning and money management, I do my best to instill in our students the fear of debt. But, you know, there are other people who disagree with me. I tell this story about how I was at a party once with, you know, fairly wealthy individuals, and they were talking about how you wanted to die with the biggest debt possible. You know, you wanted to have the hugest mortgage possible when you die. And I was thinking, you know, that's a great strategy if you know when you're going to die. But I certainly don't want to be in my 80s and 90s and be drowning in debt. If I make it, that's the thing. You know, they're saying, look, Piano, you could die tomorrow, and then what difference, what good would it do you? Which is true. So, oh well, there's the conundrum. And that, dear students, was Chapter 17, Financial Statements and Ratio Analysis. Not too exciting. It rounds out our fundamental analysis that that we started in Chapters 5 and then really went through in Chapter 6. So if we go, we'll take a quick look at the assignment sheet again. We looked at the assignment sheet on Tuesday. Whoops, that's a mistake. That's a mistake. Let's try that again. Assignment sheet in new tab. And let's make it a little bit bigger. And anybody have questions with how to use these Google Docs, you know, come see me. I apologize. I would normally hand these out to the face-to-face students. One of the perks of being a face-to-face student. But you're just going to do this. You're going to do what we just did. You don't have to do all of them unless you want to. Do at least 12, but make sure you do two from each group. Don't just look up all the common stock ratios which are available to you in Yahoo or Bloomberg or MarketWatch. Do some profitability ratios, do some liquidity activity ratios, especially that inventory turnover. I think that's a cool one myself. And then the times interest rate. Yeah, I really should put a little star next to these. Make sure you do these. And use one or two or three of these companies. Please, if you do your own company, that's fine, but make sure they're not a small, you know, podunk type company. Make sure they're a big company that has some serious earnings and some serious numbers. Yeah, market capitalization of at least $500 million on the New York Stock Exchange, on the NASDAQ. Okay, and stock 3 is optional. It's up to you. But as we said, maybe you're interested in finance. You want to do Visa and MasterCard, right? Maybe you want to do Home Depot and Lowe's or Coke and Pepsi, or just do a couple that are, and you can compare the two, because that's what we want you to do. That's the idea behind this. After we've done, or while we're doing the other fundamental analysis calculations that we did in chapters 5 and 6, or chapter 6 mostly, we also do this one to round out the picture. Cool? Okay, so it's time now for a little break. Stretch, everybody stretch, because we're ready to start some silliness with chapter 7, and then even more so in chapter 8. Okay, what happened? Okay, let's do this. Present. Let's make sure I get this right. Up. And now hit the escape key. And let's see. No, it didn't work. Okay, let's try this. Present. And now we should close this. There it goes. Okay, I'm getting the hang of this Google Docs. Okay, stretch. Everybody stretch. Wake up. Let's see who I got here. What time is it? Not bad. We got enough time to burn through this, because really, folks, We are done the heavy lifting. I think I used that term already today. We're done the heavy lifting when it comes to the Nate's here. Nate Hernandez is here, and Ms. Carla Guzman. Okay, anybody else missed? Okay. We're done the heavy lifting with regard to what is sometimes, which is usually called fundamental analysis. Okay? Fundamental analysis. I tell you beforehand that that's my bias. I believe that the best way to earn money in the stock market is to study the companies you're interested in, know as much as you can about them, and then invest for the long term, buy and hold. Of course, there's lots of other people who have very different views of the way you should go about stock investing. You know what? I think I want to show you this to you right now before we go on. Why don't I do that? See if how it works out. Because I'll show it to you again. But when we get to, we're gonna do some silliness now. But before we do that, we want to show you that, you know, it's not a guarantee, right? You're going to do hopefully you're going to do what you've learned in this class, earnings call and find out all the very easy stuff to find out, and then do your own research, do your own calculations, and you're always going to be second guessing yourself, and you're going to be wondering whether I should invest in this company versus that company. But you're going to have your eyes open. You're going to understand that, yes, this is a company like ExxonMobil. It's not going to make me a whole lot of money quickly, but it's going to be around for another 50 years or so. I'm not saying you should buy ExxonMobil. I'm just saying it's an example. As opposed to, hope you saw Neurocrine Biosciences, which is, I don't know what's going to happen with this company. Or some of the companies like, what was the one that has the teeth whitening, you know? They're probably going to disappear, but if they come back, they're going to make you a whole lot of money. So here is a documentary from Frontline, which is an excellent group from 1997, and I'm going to see if I can do this one. Sometimes it shows up really easily, sometimes not. But we're going to go see the whole thing. We're going to burn through. We're going to go to page 27, where you're going to see this woman. And her husband goes along with her. And it's not smart. It's not smart. Okay. But, and she, this was during the internet bubble when people were just making, you know, tons of gobs of money and everybody wanted to, ooh, is it too late to get in? And so watch what this woman does. And you're not going to do this, right? You're not going to do this. So let's see.
Risk averse.
Let's go. Time to go home. Come on.
Sharon eventually sold Microsoft. The next time we caught up with her, she and Russ had put their life savings into two tiny, volatile technology stocks. Why?
Because we're working very hard and not furthering ourselves. It's too slow. We have got to do something aggressive.
It is scary, but, at this point, she just wants to, Sharon? Well, actually, she took a little more and just invested recently that was very conservative, and she kind of went and did something that I think we'll make out on. As long as the market doesn't crash. But yeah, right now, just about everything's in there.
What'd she do?
She went and invested in a stock that she was told was going to do very well.
To tell you the truth, I don't even know the name of it. I know the call letters are AMLN. It's supposed to double by August. Do you worry about your future financially?
Oh, yeah. All the time. That's why we're trying to do something. That's what I'm saying. There's really nothing to depend on except yourself. So, yeah, we worry about it.
The money that people used to put in the stock market was money that they hoped to get rich on it. Get play with, or maybe finance a trip to Europe or something. What's going on today is blood money. With jobs less secure, and with the wonderful corporate pension fund that promised you a pension of X percent of your final salary when you retired. With that no longer as important and taking care of a smaller and smaller proportion, this is blood money that's in there.
So, dear students, did you hear? I don't know if you could hear that. I hope you could. She put all her money, not all, she bought two of them, but she put most of her money. First of all, he says that Microsoft was really conservative. Microsoft, at the tech bubble, it dropped, I don't know how much, 50, 60, 60%. It dropped a whole bunch. It took 10 years for it to come back. But she put it into Amylin Pharmaceuticals, which she didn't even know the name of the company. Someone told her it was going to double in 8 months or whatever. And this was a company based here in San Diego. And it promptly lost 97% of its value. It promptly went from about $13 down to 50 cents. Now, if she held on, it came back and was eventually sold. It took private. Somebody bought it by Bristol Myers Squibb at $31 a share in 2012. But do you understand? You're not going to do this. You are not going to have, you're not going to not even know the name of the company. You're going to know the name of the company. You're going to read everything you can about it. You're going to understand that a company like Amylin Pharmaceuticals, yes, could explode overnight. It was another one of those biotech. I didn't buy it. I bought other bad decisions in the late 90s in San Diego. But I knew that these were, these were gambles. I knew that going in. And so I hope that was somewhat educational for you. You're going to do well. That's the key to understanding what we've learned here. And sure, you might not be the next Peter Lynch, or you might not, be able to brag at a party that you bought the Apple when it was, $90 and then it goes to $1,000 or whatever. But you're going to do well, assuming the world doesn't end. Okay, now, we said we were doing fundamental analysis. And what we're going to learn in the next two chapters is that there are other ideas about how to invest. And so let's start now with chapter 7. Stock price behavior and market efficiency. And if I were writing this, or if I were going to name this chapter, I would call it, Can You Beat the Market? Let's get the pointer back on. Can you beat the market? And the answer is, maybe, maybe not, but who cares? That's not the important thing. The important thing is, are you going to do your research? Are you going to invest in companies that are long-term prudent investments that should do well over time? And yes, you're going to make some mistakes, but unless the world ends, you're going to do okay. And we love this quote by Sir Isaac Newton, the guy, who he didn't invent gravity. He described gravity with the story of the apple falling on his head. I can calculate the movement of the stars, but not the madness of men. And you know what? There were internet bubbles back then too. He got caught up in one and invested in the South Seas adventure and lost a lot of money. Okay, so let's now take a look at one of the other ways of investing. We talked about fundamental analysis, one of the other strategies. This is called the efficient market hypothesis, or the efficient market theory, or the random walk hypothesis. It's a theory that stock price movements are unpredictable. So if I go too fast, please scream and holler. I'm going to try to burn through this quickly because there's a lot of silliness involved. In the long term, they are not correct. But in the short term, yes, it's already been shown that stock price movements are pretty much random. And trying to guess what's going to happen in the next week or next month or even the next year is just, it's the loser's game. If we have a long-term perspective, the world doesn't end, the economy, global, does well, we bounce back from this stupid little microbe, we're going to do okay. Now, efficient market theorists say, look, in an efficient market, where there's plenty of buyers, plenty of sellers, then all prices reflect all possible information quickly and accurately. If there are large numbers of knowledgeable investors, buyers, and sellers who react quickly to that new information, the security prices will adjust quickly and accurately. And it, you know, it makes sense, sure. If you have an inefficient market where there's a few maybe sellers and lots of buyers, sure, they can do all kinds of shenanigans or vice versa. But as long as there's plenty of buyers and sellers, then it's not, then it's an efficient market. Now they were doing this work in the 70s, and they started borrowing from the physicists who had the weak theory and the semi-weak theory and the semi-strong theory. So they started using these. The weak efficiency hypothesis theory says that past data on stock prices are of no use in predicting future prices. Well, stock prices do tend to demonstrate momentum. Stock prices tend to rise more often than they fall, as we've seen. Maybe every 3 years up, 1 year down, but it never works. You know, 1, 2, 3 up, 1, 2, 3 down, or 1, 2, 3 up, and then 1 down. It doesn't work that way. And they tend to move far higher than is usually justified, mania, bubble, and then far lower than is usually warranted. And there's a great quote from Sir John Maynard Keynes. He was the economist who was very much credited with helping getting out of the Great Depression. The market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. And what does that mean? Well, he was asked by a group of very sophisticated investors when the market was way overvalued, who were shorting. They were trying to make money by knocking prices down. And they kept going up and up and up. And we're going to see in the end of the semester, don't do that. Don't short. You're going to lose a lot of money. You might make some money, but you're more likely going to lose a lot of money. It's very dangerous. And they were complaining that the market was irrational. And he said, the market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. And oh boy, this is true. This is so true. You can be absolutely sure that prices are over inflated or underinflated and be wrong in the short term. In the long term, sure, you might be right. You might be turned out to be right. But in the meantime, you have lost all your money and you're no longer solvent. And I have a very good friend who did this. In the mid-2000s, he was sure that the housing bubble was a bubble. And I agreed with him. I agreed with him wholeheartedly. But at the same time, I wasn't doing anything to fight that. I was just staying away, and I'm not interested in getting involved in this craziness. And he said, it's going to crash, it's going to crash. And he was right, but he was just too soon. He used very exotic, we'll talk about shorting later on in the semester, strategies and lost a lot of money. Yeah. So if this theory is true, then technical analysis, which we'll discuss next week, is useless. And I'm not a big fan of technical analysis. The semi-strong efficiency hypothesis. Abnormally large profits cannot be consistently earned using publicly available information. In other words, no amount of analysis that you or I do to determine the future price of a stock will help you beat the market. In other words, everything we did in chapters 5, 6, and 7 is useless. However, this is obviously not true because there are many, many investors who have beaten the market over decades, and we'll take a look at some of the more popular or more famous ones later in this presentation, in this chapter. And so the theory had to come up with a situation. It had to come up with a why is that true? You know, why are these people better than the market? And what they came up with was so ridiculous as to be, you know, laughable. They're just lucky. What? I don't call it luck, folks. If you can get into the batter's box and you can hit that fastball at 98 miles an hour, that ain't luck. You know, you just swinging at the ball, you're going to miss 99% of the time. So what do the theory say about investors? They're lucky. And so one time is a great story, and it's attributed to many different people, so I'm not sure who said it, but it was a golfer who did really, really well. And the reporter afterwards said, "Boy, you were really lucky today." And the golfer said, "You know what? You're absolutely right. And the funny thing is, the more I practice, the luckier I get." So there are people who can't hit a little white ball 400 yards down the fairway in three shots. But I ain't one of them. There are people who can dunk a basketball 10 feet, you know, 10, that thing is 10 feet up in the air. But I ain't one of them. There are people who can write an opera, sing an opera, four-hour opera, you know. And that's true for the people who have done really, really well. They can beat the market, but they're not lucky. They're just good at what they do. And again, we said if this theory is true, then everything we've learned is useless, and I don't believe that. Now, this one is patently false. No information, public or private, allows investors to earn abnormally large profits consistently. That's totally bogus, folks. One insider information trade can make you rich overnight if you don't get caught. And I want you to remember this term. We call it insider information, but the legal term, and I'm going to ask you on the exam, is material non-public information. That's the legal term. If you have material non-public information, in other words, insider information, and you trade on that, you could go to jail. Okay, you can make a fortune overnight, but you can also go to jail. And this is in the news because of what happened a few weeks ago when these senators, now it's all the senators, virtually all the senators are multimillionaires. I mean, that's just, they call it the Millionaires Club. And not all of them, but virtually all of them. And these people, I think they're worth $500 million or something like that. The wife is a senator and the husband's a big muckety muck. And they were given a private presentation about the consequences and the dangers of the coronavirus. And immediately they went out and sold stocks. They should go to jail. They won't. Obviously they won't. But they should. Because they had material non-public information. And if you or I did that, yeah, we would go to jail. But if you're a senator, no. So that's how the world works. So that's totally ridiculous. The random walk and efficient market theorists are often also major proponents of index funds. So this is where we're coming around to something we already took a look at, right? They point to the fact that many professional money managers simply do not beat the market, especially during bull markets, because from 63 to 98, the S&P 500 index outperformed general equity mutual funds. Now, this is the average of stock mutual funds, 22 out of 36 times. So they reason you're better off accepting close to, because you're not going to get the market's return because there's always some fees, with low-cost index funds, since their theory tells, get out of the way, them that no one can consistently beat the market. Are you with me? We're going back to that Chapter 4 idea where index funds are the only way you should invest because nobody can beat the market. But the truth is, it's not true. There are average mutual funds that don't beat the market, but there are above-average ones that have been beating the market for decades. Why can't many pros beat the averages? Well, as we saw, many mutual funds have high operating expenses and high turnover rates, and therefore many mutual fund managements have a very short-term time horizon. Consequently, many mutual fund managers have a short lifespan. So they know going in. Now, this is changing, thankfully, as the industry realizes the errors of their ways, that if they don't do well in 2 years, they're gone. So they might as well take very high risks. And if they do well, they get to stay and be showered with love and attention and money. And if they don't, oh well, they're going to get kicked out anyway. But now most companies are saying, no, this is not the way to play the game. So and many companies didn't do that for decades. So don't get me wrong, it wasn't the entire industry, but a lot of them. But the premises and casual observations of the efficient market theories show them to be patently absurd. Many money managers have beaten the market over long periods of time. The more I practice, the better I get, right? And this is your assignment. Your assignment, let's run to the assignment sheet for chapter 7. Your assignment sheet for chapter 7 is to go find them. Go find these people. I'm going to delete some of these. Hopefully that'll make things a lot faster. If I do... delete this guy. Oh, it's slowing down again. Yeah, I really should not have so many tabs open. Okay. That's chapter 17. So I'll get some of these tabs. Please indulge me here. And now let's zoom this up. Who has beaten the market, right? So here are the stats. And you'll notice that the Standard & Poor's 500 did pretty darn well in the last 10 years. Why? Because 2008 and 9 fell off the map. They're just looking from 2010 to 2019. And of course, we don't include what happened this last couple of months. But we want you to go into the mutual fund world and find companies that have beaten the Standard & Poor's 500. Now, you want to look at stock mutual funds, domestic stock mutual funds specifically. Don't look at a bond fund because it's, you know, you're not comparing apples to apples. And see who's beaten the market over 10 years. That's going to be relatively easy because there are these screens that you can use. They're called screens where you type in, you know, I want 10 years, beaten the S&P 500, and it'll give you a list of mutual funds. That's easy. But 20 and 30 years, a lot harder. You've got to go into the websites of the mutual fund companies and look for results since inception or lifetime results. And I really want you to do this. Now, there are six companies in the website that are very good companies. You know, four of them I think are awesome. Two are okay, in my humble opinion. And there are dozens of other companies. So you can do it. Again, enjoy. It's going to be frustrating because some companies don't really want you to know how well or badly they've done over the last 20, 30, 50 years. But so find at least 10 that have done 10 years. At least 10 domestic stock mutual funds that have beaten the S&P 500 over 10 years. At least 5 that have beaten over 20 years. And can you find any? And they're out there, folks. There are mutual funds that have been in existence for 30 plus years. So it doesn't have to be just 30 years. 50, 60 years that have beaten the S&P 500. Okay? Enjoy this. Somebody else is looking at it right now, too. Okay. and then on your own, notice that the MSCI World Index is a lot less than the Standard & Poor's 500. Right. So check out global in stock mutual funds. And yes, the United States recovered far faster from the Great Recession than the rest of the world. This is yet another example of the resilience and strength of our economy. And then we talked about why the last 10 years have been so good. So that's the assignment for Chapter 7. And we'll discuss it again, remind you, but that's why we want you to find the people who practice a lot and do really well. Now, continue. How are we doing for time? Not bad. If the markets are efficient and rational, dear students, how do you explain manias, bubbles? Occasionally, investors get caught up in what are called manias or bubbles. The internet bubble of the 1990s was the latest stock mania, in my humble opinion. Other people say there have been manias since then. A few companies, yes, but not as a market as a whole, in my humble opinion. Before that, there was the Nifty 50 of the early 1970s. These were companies that you just don't have to worry about. Xerox and Calcomp and Tektronix. Who are they? And Polaroid. Polaroid. You've never seen, most of you, a Polaroid camera. Maybe you have. But I would not want to invest in a company whose name rhymed with hemorrhoid. I just don't. That's a bad joke. Sorry. Anyway, And then the mania of the 1920s resulted in the crash of 1929. At the height of the market, Radio Corporation of America was selling for $290 a share. And then at the bottom, in 1933, it sold for $2 a share and never came back. You ever heard of Radio Corporation of America? Yeah, you have. RCA. We still use their connectors. In the 1840s, there were 400 railroad firms. Now there's less than five. But the granddaddy of them all, and it's been disputed about whether or not it really was as bad as they say it was the Dutch tulip bulb craze. You heard that right, tulip bulbs. The Dutch are famous for their tulip bulbs, but they didn't come from the Netherlands. They came from Turkey. And when they were introduced into the Netherlands, the people went wild. And they started trading these tulip bulbs as if they were stocks. And at the height of the bubble, one tulip bulb sold for what today would be $1.5 million. There's a phenomenal book that you want to read that was written in the 1840s, but still is just shocks people, called Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. One of my students said it really well. It's easier to fool 100 million people than it is to fool one. And he's absolutely right. You know, this is what the Stalinists and Nazi Germany did, and they fooled these people into thinking, yeah, this is going to be fabulous, and it wasn't. Fooled us into going into war with Iraq and weapons of mass destruction. And so it's true. It just happens that people are easily fooled in mass. And another book that you might want to read called The Botany Desire discusses the tulip bulb craze. Each time the phrase was, it's a new era, it's different this time, the old ways of valuing stock are gone, and each time they're wrong. So much for rational, efficient markets. Why do manias occur over and over again? Why haven't investors learned their lesson? What do you think, folks? Now, it's not an easy forum for you to respond. But let's stop the share for a second and go back and let's hear from you. Anybody? Why do manias go over and over again? Anybody want to? Let's do the chat. Let's go to the chat. Chat. Hear any chats? Yeah,
it's like the Beanie Baby craze.
That's right.
People only going because other people are buying.
That's right. They just see where we are. Herd animals. We are herd. We run with the herd, and we see a bunch of people running this way, so we run that way. And 100,000, 200,000 years ago, that was very useful because the people who stood around and looked at those people said, "Ooh, look at those people running that way. They're the ones that got eaten by the tiger." But now it doesn't help us in the world of finance. In fact, it can really, really hurt us. So let's go back to the sharing the screen. I'm sorry, I'm going to take up too much time, but I do want to hear from you guys. I sometimes think, why is anybody actually listening to me? I can talk about this a whole lot longer than any reasonable person would ever want to listen. I learned that a long time ago. When you empty a room, when you start talking about investments, some of them are interested. You know, why do manias occur over and over again? Why haven't investors learned their lesson? This guy said it really, really well. Market manias will happen over and over again because the public is infinitely stupid. He's right. You know, remember the woman who bought AMLN without even knowing what the name of the company was, didn't even know who they were, just bought it because someone told her that it's going to double in 6-8 months. Benjamin Graham says it this way. The speculative public is incorrigible. It will buy anything at any price if there seems to be some action in progress. It will fall for any company identified with franchising, computers, electronics, science, technology, or what have you, when the particular fashion is raging. The abuses are so largely the result of the public's own heedlessness and greed. Now, he wrote this in 1972, right? That's when computers were still, you know, big as rooms, and science and technology and franchising was, this is when McDonald's was going crazy with franchises, and 7-Eleven and the like. So now, if he were writing in 2000, he would be talking about, you know, internet and biotechnology. If he were writing now, he'd be talking about social networking, wearables, and marijuana. What else? Of course, the coronavirus. Well, Let's just hope that they do. Whether I hope they get we can create a mania with the coronavirus. That's great. It means the company's actually got something that can be useful. Let them become instant excesses overnight. So you see, you're not going to do this. You're going to stop and look and listen and watch and say, okay, fine. Maybe that company is something new that's going to be good. But you already know that most of these companies are not going to make it. One or two of them are going to make it, but most of them, you just don't know. Some people do. Some people are able, some people just buy all of them. They say, okay, I'll buy Google and Yahoo and Lycos and Go. What was the other one? Ask Jeeves and Dogpile, all the search engines, and one of them, Google won. So slide number 11. How do most manias end? Yeah, you guessed it. They invariably end with a crash. I love this saying. The bigger the party, the bigger the hangover. They are not fun, but the odds are you will live through at least one during your investing career. We're living through one right now, which, by the way, is not caused by the stock market. It's not the stock market's fault in this case, but it's just a reaction to the sadness and tragedy that's happening and the fact that the economy is grinding to not quite a halt, but oh my goodness, how many people are out of work now? 6 to 10 million people? With this many strong years, I have the concern that there are a vast majority of companies that are significantly overvalued on a long-term basis. This was a gentleman he was one of the people instrumental in the American funds, and he was one of my heroes. And then he said this in August 1999. He died in 2008. This is right before he retired. He had, at the time, 49 years of experience. He started in 1950. And then in late 2000, he retired. But he was bang on the dot. This was in August in 1999, and many of you weren't even alive then. But we were partying like it's 1999. The stock market's going to the moon. Dow is going to skyrocket. You're going to get rich, rich, rich. Everybody, quick, giving it away money. Don't miss out. And sure enough, he was absolutely right. The peak was March of 2000, and then the stock market lost 50% basically over the next 2.5 years. The NASDAQ lost 80%. The technology and the internet stocks lost 90-some percent. Oh, by the way, the 2008-09 market crash and our market crash now is not caused by the stock market bubble. The one in 2008-09 was caused by the real estate bubble and the mortgage-backed bonds that were tied to the real estate mortgages, which we'll discuss when we get the bonds. And this stock market crash is not because of the stock market. That's why I am very optimistic that we will be back, those of us who live through the virus. So here are the 13 worst days of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. How are we doing for time, folks? You still awake? I hope so. 13 worst days. Well, I just updated this because of 2020, and you'll notice that the second worst day was 16th of March, and the fifth worst day was the 12th of March. And people keep talking about, oh, it was the biggest point loss in the history. No, who cares? Don't worry about the point loss. What you're interested in is the percentage decline. And still, those of you in the face-to-face class, you saw the video. October 19th, 1987 was still the worst day in history of the markets at almost 22.6%. But you'll notice that 6 of these 13 days are in October. One of them is in early November. Now, this is a very interesting phenomenon. You would expect it to be basically randomly distributed, right? Uniformly distributed throughout the year. Why is October and November so much worse than the rest of the year? And there have been several theories, none of which actually make any sense to me, in my humble opinion, except for the one that I think is right, and there's no way to prove it, is that even though we've conquered nature, ha 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 ha, yeah, right, the coronavirus is telling us how little we've conquered nature. But we are. We are, in the modern world, immensely powerful. You flick a switch and this light bulb comes on. You turn a key, or you don't even turn a key anymore. And the car zooms to life, and you can go 60 miles in 1 hour. I mean, things that the 200 years ago, these people could not even begin to imagine. Here we are, all in different rooms, using devices that can heterogeneously link up, and we can all talk to one another. It's just astounding. And yet, we're still animals. We're still, we see the fall coming. We see the leaves turning, and then the days getting shorter, and the nights getting longer. And we panic, because 100,000 years ago, 10,000, 1,000 years ago, it was the time of death. The crops were dying. The light was fading. And there's no accident that All Hallows Eve, Day of the Dead, All Souls Day, All Saints Day, is in late October, early November, because we looked around and then we knew that some of us weren't going to make it through the winter time. And people say, well, that shouldn't that be the bleak midwinter? No. You're already in it. You're already in it. Now is the birth of hope. Now is when the days start getting longer. That's the reason why Christmas is celebrated and near the solstice, the winter solstice. They don't really know when Jesus was born, but we celebrate at that time because he was the birth of light. And so it has to do with psychology, and there's a part of psychology that's important, and we're going to discuss as we go through these next two chapters. But that's my take on it. And I'm sticking with it, and I might be totally false because we can't know a way to prove it. It's my story, and I'm sticking with it. Okay, now, do you remember this slide? Do you remember? If you don't, that's okay. But if you recall, we heard in Chapter 4 that index funds are the only way to invest. Nobody can beat the market. Well, the problem is when we do have these market manias, and we do have these market crashes and the like, index funds have no way to defend against this. You hear people say, instead of trying to beat the market, just buy the market and be happy with the market return. And we showed you this slide, and you probably didn't understand what the hell was going on, but now you do. Hopefully you do. Because if you look at the MSCI EAFE, remember that? That's the foreign market, the international market, the overseas market. In the late 80s, at the end of 1989, Japan, which was just one, remember, you have Canada, Western Europe, Australia, Hong Kong, Singapore, and Japan made up the EAFE. But Japan made up 60% of the EAFE with a PE of almost 52. And now you understand that that's a really high PE for an entire market. Maybe one company demands a PE of 52. But the entire Japanese stock market, which then went on to lose over 80% of its value. Whereas Western Europe and Canada and Australia and Hong Kong and Singapore and South Africa, they made up 40% with a much lower 13 PE. So you thought you were getting a broadly diversified international index fund when you were skewed, you were over-exaggerated, over-invested in one company that was outrageously expensive. And the same thing happened in the late 90s when the stock market went up and way up, and specifically the internet, the telecom and the others just exploded. So out of all the stocks, remember all the industries in the United States, and there are many, right? The information technology world made up one third with a PE of almost 60. Higher than Japan's. Whereas everybody else, energy, healthcare, materials, housing, all the other things that the United States isn't famous for, made up two-thirds with a PE of 20, which is pretty high for a market as a whole, but not as high as 60. And then, as we said, the S&P 500 went on to lose 50% of its value, whereas the NASDAQ technology sector lost over 80% of its value. This is another reason, or this is one of the big reasons, why I'm not a big index fund fan. And you get people very angry at you because they want their bias, they want their strategy to be confirmed, and here you are, some goofball saying that, no, I'm not a big fan of index funds, and they get really angry at you because you don't agree with them. Oh, well. And I tell them about this, and they don't want to hear it. Okay, the argument for active management, and we're almost out of time because we're almost ready because wait, this next thing, yeah, right. This is where we're going to end right here. This is what I was just describing. Today in the financial media, index funds and ETFs are touted as the better alternative to actively managed mutual funds. As we saw, index funds do have the advantage of very low cost indexing in investing. That should be true. Be careful. As we said, some third party administrators are going to try to sneak in a high cost index fund into your 401k because they can, the big jerks, and you're going to call them out and you're going to look like a genius and all your coworkers and friends are going to say, where did you learn that? And you're going to tell them, take Business 123 introduction to it. Anyway, but many decades ago, when you read The Intelligent Investor, you will see where Benjamin Graham warned against any investment strategy that relied on deterministic or robotic decision-making and removed the element of human judgment. And here's a gentleman who just got out of the industry, but he had, I guess, like 34, 35 years of experience when he retired. As with any human endeavor, whether it is athletic competition, the performing arts, or technological innovation, some people clearly perform at a higher than average level. And he's right. You know, there are people who can hit a fastball at 98 miles an hour or throw a fastball at 98 miles an hour, who can dunk a basketball, maybe two, at the same time. And there are people who can beat the market or at least do a whole lot better than the average individual. Cool? And that's my story, and I'm sticking with it. And if anybody jumps at you or screams at you because you don't love index funds, tell them, talk to Payano, all right? Okay, so this is where we will break for today. When we come back, we're going to take a look at some more silliness. And then to finish up our Chapter 7, we will take a look at I call them all-stars of investing. And see why what makes them different about and alike to us and different than the rest of people and different than us also. So hopefully you are enjoying our time together, even though we're not together. We're online. It reminds me of my son, who he and his buddies get together often throughout the week at night playing League of Legends, but mostly they're just talking to one another. They got their headsets on, and they're gaming, and they're talking with people all around the world. And our son sent us this cute photo. I guess they're called memes or something like this. It says, has video gamer before the coronavirus. And it has a guy playing video games with his headset on, and he's in front of a computer by himself. And then and below it says, video gamer after the coronavirus. And it has the same picture. He's just sitting there playing video games on his own with his headset on. So I sometimes feel like that. I'm talking to 16 people, and maybe some of you are actually listening, and I really appreciate it. We are very, very proud of all of you. And so let us now stop this share. And so I want to make sure I get everybody. I think I did get everybody. If not, I apologize. So Nate. I mean, Ruben, Arden, Eric, Janet, Alejandro, Nicholas, Simon, Diaz, I got everybody. Tammy Flores. All right, so let's stop with any questions now. I'm gonna. Any questions? Any thoughts? Ideas? Yes? No? Okay, we just gained somebody or lost somebody. I'm not sure. Okay, so I'm going to stop the. The recording. This will be available before the end of the day for you to review. As we said, keep working, studying every day. We're so proud of you. We have our exam number 3 next Thursday after next week's session. And And so contact me if you have any questions about the worksheets and the like. If you did not turn in the assignments, I mean, turn in all your late assignments. And also, if you did not take exam number two, contact me also. Okay, so I'm going to stop the recording now. So how do I stop the recording? How do I stop? No, I want to end meeting. I want to. Oh, here it is. Stop the recording. Stop recording. There it is. Yes, I want to stop the
recording. The recording has stopped.
Hey, yeah, I'll stop this one too. I'm recording with my.